Welcome back to Chasing Perfection, a UConn women's basketball podcast presented by the UConn Women's Basketball Weekly. We are through the first couple rounds of the NCAA tournament into the regionals. Two victories for the Huskies, as expected. 32 years in a row that they have made the Sweet 16, and this certainly was not going to be the year that that turned. They take down UTSA in the first round, 90-52, and then they put in a historic first half against Syracuse to win 98-45, not remotely as close as that final score would indicate. Remember how for a few years there, we were talking about how that second round game has gotten a whole lot tougher, and it's not the guarantee that it used to be for UConn?
Yeah, I do remember that. And we've seen many of them. Like, even just a couple of years ago, they played Syracuse again with Deja Fair, and it was like a, I think, an 8-point game at the end of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was certainly not the case this year.
No, I think the difference is not only is UConn a lot better, UConn's on the one line. So yeah, the team that they play in that second round is slightly worse than they would have with a 7-10 game, or even the 6-11 game. I think Syracuse was a 6, if I'm not mistaken, back in 2024. Oh,
yeah. Because they were the 3. Yeah, forgot about that.
So that gap, but mostly it's UConn, is so much better than they have been in a lot of years. And like last year's second round game wasn't particularly close either, but I was laughing about that at some point, either today or last night, how that had been a tough game for a couple of years for them. And nothing about that game yesterday was tough.
Yeah, nothing at all.
We have two places we can start. We can start on an individual level, just as we did with our short little rapid recap, if you listen to it, or team level. Where should we go?
I'm still going to go individual level here. I just think, like, as much as there's, like, so many great things to say about the overall team performance in the Syracuse game, like, you have to just start with AC.
Yeah. A career high 34 points. Tied a career high, I should say, with 34 points and 8 made threes. 26 of those points in the first half, which I believe is a career high. We have seen it before where she's just exploded like that, and it's honestly, I think, a skill to be able to do. But this year, her season has been so defined by consistency that there haven't been those flashes where she is just unstoppable. And I really honestly expected it to come at some point, and here it was. I think that's a really good sign going into the rest of the tournament, because it doesn't necessarily have to be 34 points, but if she hits 3 threes in a row at really any point in any game down the stretch, I'm going to venture to guess that UConn's going to win that game.
Yeah. No, just having that explosiveness in her, like you said, we haven't seen it a lot this season, but that's kind of like the straw that can break the camel's back for the other team. Like, if you're in a close game, like at some point you would have to imagine this team is going to be in a close game, whether it's in the regional round or once they get to Phoenix. And if she can just come out and, like you said, hit 3 of them back to back like that, like, that just creates such separation and a chance for UConn to kind of run away with things.
The fun story off of AZ's big night, if you missed it, which I don't know if embarrassed is the right word. I didn't know that Holly Rowe had asked AZ about it during the game. I thought it was some like exclusive thing we got post game until I saw the clip online eventually. I don't remember when, but if you did miss it, AZ checks out at the end of the first half and Gino kind of stops her, grabs her hands, and then gives her an "I told you so" look. And she explained after the game that he had told her that she needed to cut her nails after a, I believe it was a 1-of-5 shooting night against UTSA in the opening round. And it wasn't that, like, I couldn't hear AZ when she was giving us this explanation the first time because there was a big crowd around her. It's really loud in the locker room. So I thought the explanation was, your nails are too long, you're changing your trajectory of your shot because it's hitting the nails and coming off your fingers differently than you'd expect. No, it had nothing to do with that. It was her nails were digging into the ball and it hurt the ball. So if she cut her nails and filed them, it would make the ball happy and the ball would like her more and it would go in. That is such an awesome story. And the best part is Gino goes, AZ and Ice looked at me like I was some idiot, and I turned and walked away and said, well, I don't actually believe it either, but you might as well try it. AZ tried it. I think she's going to keep her nails pretty trim the rest of the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I think they're going to be short until after the national championship game, assuming they get there.
The best part about that, too, is AZ said she had given up her superstition. She had had a bad shoot around that day, and typically that would have thrown her all off, but no more superstitions, except she tries essentially some, I don't know what the right word is. I almost feel like hippie magic, like that has like a very like tree hugger, like, oh, there's so much energy in the world. You need to emit positive energy, love everybody. I don't know if it's hippie vibes, but it's just so funny that, yeah, the one who gave up all her superstitions decided to bring one back just to give it a shot.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a great story, and a fun one, too. I feel like there's always, like, these little fun stories in March, and it's fun to see them come out.
It's easier to get them in March because you get them in the locker rooms, and that's you can fair. Ask other people. And
things we don't get all season long, yes.
Yeah, this one's maybe not the best example, but there's been so many times that we'll be in the locker room post game and someone else will mention something and it's like, oh, I didn't know about that. And then that's how it starts to go around. But yeah, a fun story from top to bottom. And then talking about the team, just an unbelievable first half that they put together. They go on a 31-0 run at one point between the first and second quarter, held Syracuse without a basket for over 10 minutes. They led by 53 at halftime, somehow not even their biggest halftime lead in the NCAA tournament, but I guess that's what happens when you score 94 points and a half one time. It was the type of onslaught, wave, just unstoppable force, runaway train that we've certainly seen from this team, but it has been quite a while since we've seen it.
Yeah, I can't really think of, like, a time this season that we've, like, really seen it. I mean, they've obviously had moments where it's been great, but, like, I don't think we've seen it in the capacity that we saw it in this game. And, I mean, I think Gino said it afterwards, too. Like, it's the best half of basketball he's watched in a long time. And I mean, maybe, like, if you think, I can't remember the specifics of, like, maybe, like, the national championship, like, last year, something like that, where those two games that they just, like, came out and it was never really close. But yeah, just a completely dominant run in a way that it kind of reminds you of like the old, like the Stewie teams where it was just like,
yep,
decided in 5 minutes.
Yep. I think Gino did say last year after the UCLA game that they played a perfect half against them. That first half was really good. I'm also scrolling through the schedule and none of these match, but like they're the closest things we've gotten to this point. Of the first quarter against Louisville, I thought was really impressive. Mm-hmm. The first quarter against Michigan was really good. Right. Obviously forget based on how it went later. They had a stretch during the USC game where they really just flew. Those are the big ones, I think. Like maybe that third quarter into the fourth quarter against Tennessee. It hasn't happened a whole lot though, and I thought it was interesting. The one Gino pointed to was the first half against Mississippi State back in the 2016 Sweet 16, obviously not the game that happened next against Mississippi State. That one certainly had nothing perfect about it. Jim Fuller, who now works for the AP but was with the New Haven Register for a really long time covering this team, mentioned the first half against Old Dominion. Gino said at the time that that was the best 10 minutes of basketball he'd ever seen anyone play. I think they missed one shot, or they shot like 90-something% in that half. And that game was still close. That's what I couldn't believe. I went and looked up that game, and it wasn't like they just ran away with it in the way that they did with this one. Like, it was 21 points, but I think it was close at one point. Yeah, Old Dominion went on a 15-6 run and got within 14. So, like, they never really had a shot to get back in it. But, like, 15 still feels really close in the grand scheme of the greatest 10 minutes you've ever seen of basketball.
Right.
it's been a while, but those ones are just so much fun because there was nothing that Syracuse was going to be able to do to stop it. There's times where opposing teams are complicit in UConn going on a big run, and there's times that they are a car in front of a freight train, and you're going to get smashed whether you're there or whether you're driving towards it. That's a terrible analogy, but either way, like
it. It's a new one.
Yeah. Either way, Syracuse was complicit. I do want to talk about that, but like, I don't think it mattered that Syracuse wasn't ready to play that game.
No, I think UConn just came out with such an energy that, like, I don't really think it mattered what the other team did or what they were ready for, that it wasn't really going to make a difference. And I think it stemmed from a lot of things, right? Like, it stemmed from their defensive pressure. Like, that's always the first thing. But it stemmed from easy hitting their shots. It was just, everything was firing on all cylinders. Like, about as perfect as you can get in a half of basketball.
There are a few moments that reminded me of the time they played Syracuse in the bubble during the tournament, where, if you remember, Olivia Nelson-Adota just started shredding the 2-3 zone of Syracuse, where it was like, are you not going to do anything else to try and stop this? And how many times did UConn basically just get the ball and walk straight to the rim for a layup? I mean,
so many times.
It's one thing to just be getting, like, belted. I gotta add that one to my recap list. But, like, you can still put in the effort. You can still put up a fight. And I think the fact that I didn't find this out until today, Holly Rose said that after halftime, Syracuse players were coming out of the locker room back onto the floor crying.
Oh, my God.
Like, that's... Damn.
Yeah. Yikes.
So, yeah. It was special. It was special to watch, and... just, yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah, no, just really, this is such a perfect half basketball.
I did find it pretty interesting. So Felicia Leggett Jack, nothing but, if nothing else, she is an honest coach when she's talking post game. She said she knew they were in trouble at 2:30 during shoot around because she could see the weight of the history of UConn sitting on them as they were on the court at Gamble Pavilion, and they've got the banners, and they've got the Huskies of Honor in one corner. They've got the national championships and all the achievements listed out in another one. And Coach Jack said that the weight was so heavy on them that they literally could not even make the free throws they were taking in practice. How often do we hear coaches and opposing teams say, you know, you don't have to play Maya Moore and Brianna Stewart and Diana Taurasi and all those great players. You just got to play the current team. Not that that's an easy task, but you can't let the history get you. Right. And Syracuse let the history get them and lost that game before the opening tip even went into the air.
Yeah, I do think it kind of speaks, though, to, like, where this UConn team has returned to, right? Because I think there was a handful of years there, and, like, we talked about the year that they were... like a 3 seed, the years that they were 2 seed, where maybe some of that edge of just being UConn had kind of gone away, because, like, they were losing games in the regular season, and there was a little bit more of that, like, oh, we could get them kind of vibe. And I think this team has just done away with that kind of sentiment for a lot of teams.
Oh, 100%. I mean, when they were so injured like that, yeah, they could, teams could start to look and say, hey, look, this streak broke. Like, why can't we play them? This isn't the UConn team of old. And that really changed when they won that national title last year in the fashion that they did it. Where when UConn is at its best, it doesn't matter what anyone else in the country is doing, because UConn's going to win. Like, the fact that we can count on one hand the number of times that UConn has been the better team and didn't win, it's 97, which I think I'm pretty sure involved an injury. Was that the Shea Ralph ACL year?
It might have been, yeah.
I think it was. Was it 98 the next year where they lost to that 10-loss Tennessee team? No, I think 10-loss Tennessee was 97, if I'm not mistaken. And then 2001 losing that Final Four to Notre Dame. But granted, that team had a million injuries. And then the 2 years post-Stewie where they, like, simply didn't have that intangible it factor to get over the top. Those are the only times we can talk about that a UConn team has been this good. Like, no one else can reach a peak that a UConn team can peak. Yeah. A peak that a UConn team can reach. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. Yeah, it's just like, there's just... I mean, maybe, like, you can probably point to... No, actually, I don't know. It's even, like, South Carolina, though. They lost to that Iowa team that they had, like, no business listening to. I don't know. Like, I don't really think there is anyone that compares. South Carolina's probably the closest, but it's still not really...
Yeah, well, the undefeated season that South Carolina had, they needed a miracle three to be undefeated.
Yeah.
It's not like that was just some... UConn has not needed a miracle to stay undefeated. Right. All but one win has been by double digits. The one game that wasn't, they led from wire to wire.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we saw that next level. It was similar to the South Carolina game, not in the sense that the unexpected nature, but like... Yeah, it's in them. They can do this to teams, and they're not going to do this all four quarters every single game the next four games. If you do this for 5 minutes a game, you're going to beat everyone by 20.
Yeah.
So let's run through some other top performers from... We can do this weekend at large, but obviously I think the Syracuse game has a little bit more relevance. Who else did you like from these past two games?
I mean, we can start with Blanca because I thought she had two fantastic games. The first game against UTSA, we'll get into some of the struggles that the team had in that game, but I thought she came in off the bench and like just was able to really get things going in a way that I thought was really important. And then probably even more importantly, to not just have it be, especially as a freshman and like in your first NCAA tournament, to have it not just be one game, but then to follow it up against Syracuse with 18 points, like 7 of 9 from the floor. Like, it just, she stuffed the rest of the stat sheet categories too, right? Like 4 assists, 3 rebounds, a couple steals, a couple blocks. To do it in back-to-back games, I think really bodes well for what they're going to get from her this coming weekend and the following weekend.
She's so good.
Yeah.
I still get that same giddiness, I think is probably the right word, when I watch her now as I did at the beginning of the season, because you never know what you're going to see. And like, I know early in the season, the joke was like, you never know what you're going to see. You hope it's good. It's a lot more good than bad. She had this one play against Syracuse where she basically just bull rushed the defense to the basket and then put it in with this like really nice little finesse layup. Like, it's the physical tools, it's the skill, and then it's just the intangibles of not only her smarts, but the fact that nothing that happens before affects her going forward. And that goes a little bit both ways, because when she's doing really well, that doesn't mean it's going to continue. But I think more notably for a freshman, if things aren't going well, that doesn't matter to her at all. So she's so much fun. She's so good. And like, if this is only the start, then it's just crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Just insane. It's probably only going to go up from here, which is pretty crazy to think about when you think of some of the things that she's already doing.
As Gino always says, this is the worst that freshmen are ever going to be, ideally. I feel like we should talk about Sarah Williams, because only has 2 points against Syracuse, but Uche Zoje, I thought, was awesome. Like, I know she didn't have a great game because Sarah Williams shut her down, but just watching her out there, you can see the talent. You can see how good she is. And I know she's what, 21? So she's not your typical freshman, but still, as we're seeing with Blanca, not that Blanca's that old, but being a freshman is still being a freshman in some capacity. Maybe you have a little bit more maturity, especially her. She hasn't seen her family in 8 years, which is, I would love to know more about her story. I only really just learned about her. But, oh man, she is an unbelievable talent, I thought, and Sarah Williams won that battle handily. And I don't really care what the stats are. There's just a look in Sarah Williams' eye, a fire that she's playing with that she hadn't had all season, really, until that Big East tournament. You got to feel really good about her, because these are a lot of performances that we're stacking together against a lot of different teams in a lot of big moments. We're running on probably like a month straight that Blanca's, or sorry, that Sarah Williams has looked above average.
Yeah. No, I agree. I thought she had like a great game in the Syracuse game, maybe one of her best so far at UConn, which, like, when you look at the stat sheet, doesn't maybe necessarily feel like it adds up. But I, like you said, I don't really think the stats matter so much. Like you said, defensively, I think, first of all, what she did defensively was probably the most important thing she could have done in that game, and also, like, the best thing she did in the game. But I thought she was good on the glass, even though, like, the rebound numbers aren't super high. Like, I thought she was great on the glass. She had some really, really nice, like, feeds into the post with, like, AZ cutting in or others cutting in, like, some nice assists. I thought she just looked very comfortable out there and played a really, really good game.
I almost think it's better that the numbers aren't showing how good she is, because it's not about the numbers with what they need from her.
Right.
They just need her to go out there and perform. That's what Gino's been saying all year about the Pigs. What were Jana's numbers in the NCAA tournament last year? Could you name a single number about her? And yet we always talk about how good she was in those games because of how valuable she was playing defense and doing all of that. So, yeah, it's kind of the same way. If you get 10 points, 12 points from her, great. But if you don't, like, if she's still contributing, that's all you need.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you think about, like, Jana's performance, the numbers didn't matter. It was all, the numbers that mattered was, like, how few points or how inefficient, like, Lauren Betts was, not Jana's numbers themselves. So, yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like, the numbers don't matter if she's out there contributing in the ways that she did in this game and helping them defensively. And the defense part is the biggest thing. They don't really need more points to go around. This team can score plenty of points. But they need someone that can go out there and make it difficult for the other team's best player in the post to score points, because it's only going to get, well, actually, not necessarily only going to get more difficult from here on out, because Miguche is one of the better players in the post that they'll see probably until the Final Four. But, like, having someone out there that can slow down another team's post player, when you think about the fact that you've probably got a game with UCLA or something like that coming, I think is really important.
Every time I go look at Lauren Betts' stat line in that Final Four game, for how much we talk about Jana, deservedly so, I will say, do you want to guess what her numbers were? If you don't know them?
I'm sure it was still, like, high. I don't know them. Did she have, she probably still had, like, 15 points, 20 points, but it was probably 26. Less efficient. 26, okay. But was it inefficient 26 points?
It was 11 for 18.
Okay, that's not bad.
No, but, like, you want to go back and watch the game.
It was 11 for 18, not, like, you know, 19 for 30 or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, also, only 5 rebounds.
Yeah.
But I think those numbers really lie, too, because, like, what I don't have
how much of it came in the second half when that game was already over. Yeah.
Yeah. But even still, like, just watching that game, Jana won that battle. And or maybe she didn't win it, but she won the war. She did what she needed to do to win the war. Yeah. But every time I go look up those numbers, I laugh, like, oh. Because Reagan Beers objectively had a really bad game. Right. Kiki Iriafin didn't make a basket after the first quarter, I think. And then Lauren Betts isn't quite that same category, but, like, that's not taking anything away from Jana. I more just find it funny every time I go pull up that box score.
Yeah. It is funny because I don't remember it like that. Probably because a lot of it probably happened in the second half, like we said. Like, it was already over.
Game was over at halftime. I think AZ scored like 2 points after halftime, and yet we talk about it as this, like, all-time AZ game. Deservedly so. We don't talk about the bad fourth quarters in Big East games. It's the same concept.
Yeah.
Anyone else stand out to you from the first two rounds of the tournament?
I thought Ashlyn had two really good games. Another one where maybe it doesn't necessarily show fully in the stats, but I think Just like the way she was contributing, it wasn't necessarily like a barrage of scoring. Well, she scored well in the first game, but in the second game, not so much. But like, just like the rebounds, the assists, she's just like so. I feel like she comes up with so many of the 50-50 balls, which like there's nothing you can point to on the stat sheet that's like, oh, that's what that is. But like, it just feels like every time there's like a 50-50 ball, she's in the mix for it.
I think she's just the perfect player for this team. Yeah. Because you've got the scorers, you've got the defensive players, you've got basically someone for everything, and you can't look at Ashlyn and say she helps you with this. Like, yeah, she can hit some shots, but if she's not hitting shots, that's not going to make or break the season. She's gotten really good defensively, but whether or not she's on the floor isn't going to affect how good this team is playing defensively. She's passed the ball really well, but she's not your point guard. Like, she just makes winning plays, and it doesn't matter what those are, and it kind of can change different games. Maybe they do need her to score 15 one night because AZ's shots aren't falling, or Sarah's in foul trouble, or this or that. Maybe they don't need her to score any points, but they need her to go grab four huge offensive rebounds, and no one crashes the glass harder on the offensive end, particularly, than Ashlyn. So for a team that's so loaded with talent, so loaded with high-end talent, has so many different pieces that they can deploy to change the game, she is just so plug-and-play, and it might look different every single night, but you're going to get something from her.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the type of players this team needs. They don't necessarily need another player that's going to go out there and score 15 points every night. Like, they've got enough, so many options, but having the type of player that's going to give you what you need is so important.
Yeah. So I have a bunch of stuff to write a really good story on her soon. I got to figure out when I'm going to have the time for that, because it's quite a compressed schedule coming up going into regionals, which we will get to in a second, but I don't want to totally gloss over the UTSA game, even though there's not a whole lot to talk about at this point. It's the classic, if we recorded an episode after this game, it would be a much different conversation than recording it now, because it was not a particularly great day from UConn. They really started slow from the field. My biggest takeaway, I only got to watch the first half. I had to go up to Boston to cover hockey, and it felt like to me like a typical first game after 12 days off. You want to see them beat a 16 seed, especially a particularly lowly 3 seed. Like, this wasn't some regular season and tournament champion that got underseeded. They snuck into the tournament with a good run late, and maybe they were better than their overall record showed, but like, in a vacuum, you would have wanted them to beat them much more comfortably. But then you go and do Syracuse, and like, okay, what are we supposed to be worried about from UTSA now?
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe to just look at the positive of the UTSA game, because I think anything that was negative, like after the Syracuse game, I didn't think there's not much to be worried about on anything. But you had a game where AZ Fudd and KK Arnold are in foul trouble and like can't be on the floor for a lot of the second quarter. So you needed other players to step up, and I think the bench did an excellent job of stepping up. I mean, Ashlyn too, and even just some of the starters, like, right? They needed people to score with those two on the bench, and Ashlyn had 14 points. But we talked about Blanca already. Kaylee Heckel also, I thought, had a fantastic game. She brought, it doesn't necessarily show, well, she scored 11 points, so it somewhat shows, and had 5 assists, so it somewhat shows in the stat sheet. But I think the defensive energy that she brings, like, she could kind of just match what you get from KK in a lot of ways. So it wasn't like you have a gap there with her on the court over KK, with KK being in foul trouble, and then she was scoring, she was facilitating. So I thought the bench just was able to really step up and play some really important minutes. And I thought that was really positive to see, because when you, like, especially after the Syracuse game, right, like, you're not worried that KK Arnold and AZ Fudd aren't going to figure it out in this tournament. They've been here before. They know what to do. But I think to be in that situation early where kind of there was some pressure on the bench to step up and do things, and to see them deliver is a good sign.
couple years ago, if they lose two of anyone to foul trouble, you literally have no subs left.
Right.
I mean, if it was the year they went to Cleveland, I legitimately think they had Nash too. Mm-hmm. So they would have still had someone on the bench, but it would have been riding with Ice and Caden Samuels the entire time. Like, just the fact that they have depth alone and depth that's good enough to overcome the loss of those two is pretty significant.
Yeah, exactly. It's something this team hasn't had in a while. And it's part of what makes them so good.
Yeah. Last thing to wrap up this weekend. As we talked about a lot, this was Syracuse's fourth trip to Storrs. Sorry, not fourth trip to Storrs. This was their fourth time playing UConn in the second round of the NCAA tournament. One of those was in the bubble in San Antonio during the COVID season. Second time in Syracuse's last two tournament appearances for Syracuse coach Felicia Leggett-Jack. This was her third time coming to Storrs in the second round because she came with Buffalo as the head coach in 2019. Afterwards, she goes on a big rant and says that it feels like a personal attack that they continue ending up here. As our resident bracketologist, what did you think of her complaints and how she went about broaching the issue?
I get her point, right? Like, no one wants to play mm-hmm. UConn, and that kind of comes with the territory of what UConn is. I do think it's a little bit interesting, though, because, well, one, the reason they keep ending up here is, like, the committee's trying to keep them regionally near where they are. So, like, the committee's trying to help them, even though it's not helping them. Right? Like, they're trying to say you get to play, you know, a 4-hour, 5-hour drive from home instead of a flight or going to the West Coast, or, like, those are the alternatives, right? But then I also think it's, like, a little bit of a weird situation because it's not like it's, like, the 8-9 game every year and they're in the same 8-9 game. Like, UConn's been all over the place. They've been all over the place in terms of seeding. I get where she's coming from, but, like, also at the same time, like, is it really going to be that much different if you go play Syracuse? Or not Syracuse, if you go play South Carolina? Like, or if they went to play UCLA? I don't know. Ultimately, like, I think you're running into a buzzsaw no matter what.
Yeah, I sympathize with her, and I agree with her in the sense that there's no reason Syracuse should be UConn's matchup in the second round four times in a decade. Right. And part of that is simply because every other power conference team in the Northeast stinks right now. So BC is not making it to the tournament ever. Rutgers is on its 15th head coach. Penn State doesn't do anything. Pitt doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
I think
that's a good point. Like, that is actually probably what's, like, driving that a lot more.
Yeah. So if you're a good enough Power 5 team to be making the tournament, but you're not ending up in contention to host, then unfortunately you're going to start drifting into UConn's sphere. I just think, though, part of the fun of the NCAA tournament is the experience. And 16 seeds know they're going to lose. But if, let's just use Vermont as an example, because they've gotten to the tournament a bunch. If the committee was just sending Vermont to UConn every single year, Vermont would have every right to be pissed. Because right. They know they're going to lose that game. Granted, they gave Louisville a pretty good game. But you know you're going to lose that game. Every 16 seed, whether or not they want to say it pregame or not, knows in their hearts, or I think any 16 seed that's taking their best advantage of being in the NCAA tournament should almost accept that you're going to lose that game so that you can enjoy the experience. And right. I think for Syracuse, give them a different experience. Yeah, go send them to UCLA, because some of these kids might not have ever been to LA, or they get to play on the same court that John Wooden coached and all those great players. Like, send them to South Carolina, because South Carolina is a really cool place to play and they're the new hip program. I don't know if anyone would be excited to go to Texas, but, you know, next year,
coming from Syracuse, it's warm.
Next year, USC is going to be in the NCAA, or is probably going to be on the one line.
Right.
And you get to go play Juju Watkins. So I understand it that you're, I think they deserve a different experience than four times in a decade. I think thinking that it's like some personal attack on you,
yeah, not much.
Like, it was the exact same thing with when you were at Buffalo. You were close. Yeah. It's not like she was at Florida A&M and landed with UConn, and then she went and coached Indiana and she landed with UConn, and then like, and it kept happening. So yeah, I get her point. I get her frustration. I think her frustration is plenty valid, but she just needed to stop it. It's ridiculous that we keep getting sent here and I keep getting sent here. Give my student athletes something right. different to experience. Let someone else get the experience of coming to play UConn. Yeah. You could even frame it that way.
Yes. Yeah.
So, it's tough, but you also had one player that was on the last time you came to stores, so you still do get a new, experience, for most yeah. everyone in the program.
And that's probably part of it, too. It's like, they do try to avoid, they're at least supposed to try to reward, like, rematches of the prior year tournament to an extent, but like when it's been 3 years, like that kind of goes out the window.
Yeah. So looking forward to UConn Syracuse in the second round next year.
That, and also I think the other thing, I mean, Syracuse because the ACC you could have moved, but like I think the big conferences, like it's making it harder and harder to adjust things around without like breaking other rules.
I think we got to change the rules. Did we talk about this last yeah. episode? I think we got to change them. You don't have to change them completely, but how about you just can't face a team from your conference earlier than the Sweet 16?
Yeah, I think that's... And, I mean, there is rules like that. I mean, that's basically what the rule is, other than, like, in the top four seeds that they have to be in, like, different regions. But other than that, it's like... You can't meet before the regional final if you've played three times in the regular season. Otherwise, you have flexibility. So, like, yeah, if they've played three times in the regular season, I'm fine with trying to avoid that matchup, right? Like, no one wants to yeah. see it for a fourth time.
But at the same time, if you're going to give... If that rule is going to inherently give someone an advantage or a disadvantage, like... I just can't get over Iowa getting with South Carolina. When yeah. everyone knew that Iowa team wasn't anything special.
I hear you, but I also just don't see it changing because with units, like none of the big conferences are going to go for that. Like yeah. they want their top four teams. Like especially when you look at like the SEC, right? That has like four teams that are legitimate Final Four contenders. Like they want them set up to win as many games as possible.
Generally, the conferences don't want anyone else even in the tournament.
Yeah,
so, well, but too. Like, but... you got to play ball with them. It's not like you can just make these right. changes unilaterally. But
yeah, yeah.
I think if you change the rules to where it's much more strict about you can't have interconference matchups at any point before the Elite Eight if you can help it, whereas like Oklahoma is going to play South Carolina in the Sweet 16.
Yeah, Texas is playing. Kentucky, Minnesota yeah. is playing UCLA. In hindsight, it feels like there was probably some maneuvering that could have been done there to make that a little better, but whatever.
I think that's if you replace it with, okay, you can play a team in the Elite Eight, but you can't play them in the Sweet 16, it balances out in a sense, because if the SEC has four teams that are capable of making it to the NCAA tournament, then Or maybe put in some provision that the number one overall seed gets the weakest two seed no matter yeah. what. And yeah. then you have to build around that. Like, I don't think it's really a huge issue this year with how good UConn is. But imagine if it's imagine UConn's the number one overall seed, and then 2-3 are SEC schools, and then the 5th and 6th teams are both SEC schools that are really good teams. I can't think of a good recent example of like a 2 seed that would be competing for a national championship. And then like the 8 seed everyone knows is not that much better than the 13-14 seed. I'm like really stretching the... But just like where like UConn is now suddenly having to play Was Texas a one last year? They were. I want like a concrete example, but like if UConn suddenly has to play another national title contender despite being the number one overall seed, and I'm not even going to use South Carolina because this isn't an anti-South Carolina thing,
right.
And USC gets to play a really weak number two because Michigan was going to be the one they were lined up with. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it just, if you're outside those two conferences that are going to dominate, then you're at a natural disadvantage.
Yeah, that's fair.
So that's my rant for the day. I feel strongly about that one. Alrighty, let's look ahead to regionals down in warm Fort Worth. We will both be down there, so if you have any recommendations for what to do, I was looking at it today. I'm only there 4 days, like fully. I get in late and then I leave pretty early given they have the early extra day. So I don't know how much time I'll have to explore, but I do love recommendations. So yeah, send them our way if you've got them. They will take on 4-seed North Carolina in the Sweet 16. I think I saw somewhere that they opened as 27.5-point favorites. They have played North Carolina each of the last 2 years. Fairly competitive games, all things considered. Neither one that UConn really felt like it was in trouble. Obviously, this year's UConn team is significantly better than even where last year's was when they played North Carolina. I just like can't even get up to pretend that they have any chance at losing this game.
Yeah, I was really struggling with this one. I was doing my other podcast this morning and College Sports Now, and like this game, I don't know what it does. It just like it really doesn't do anything for me, and like I don't even see the path for North Carolina. And some of the other 1-4s or 1-5s, I can see the path. Like I don't think it's gonna happen, but I can see the path. Like I don't even see the path for South Carolina or for North Carolina to beat UConn.
I mean, Oklahoma beat South Carolina already this season, right? So yes. Objectively, you can see the path for that.
Yeah.
But this is one of those teams on the level that UConn's already played this season. I mean, UConn's killed Iowa, who was a 2-seed, Louisville, who is a 3-seed, I think. Maybe they haven't played anyone like equivalent, but they've mm-hmm. beaten better teams by a significant margin, and they've beaten teams like Notre Dame being a 6 is fairly in the same range, I would say.
Yeah.
And they had no issue. Elite Eight, we'll get into. Like, I can at least see the vision for that one, but yeah. if it's Vandy. But yeah, even if it's Notre Dame. But this one, like, I don't know. I really don't have a whole lot of juice to talk about.
Yeah, I guess the thing is, like, North Carolina is always going to bring a good defense, right? Like, it's not going to be an easy offensive night for UConn, but at the same time, North Carolina is just not a team that scores a lot of points.
Leading scorer has 11.5.
Yeah, like, I just think UConn has way too much offensively for them to compete. It's just feels like there's not much to break down on this one. Like, it's just like, yeah, UConn's gonna win this.
Yeah. I don't even recognize a ton of these names. Like, I remember Sierra Toomey from when UConn was recruiting her, mm-hmm. and she's having an okay season. India Navarre's been there for a few years, if I remember right. And then Nyla Harris, that name is also familiar to me.
Yeah, Alina Arasal was a freshman at UCLA last year, transferred to North Carolina this year. She's had a pretty good year for them. She's brought some offense that they've been lacking, to say the least, in prior seasons. So, like, they have some good pieces. It's just, like, UConn clearly has the first and second best player on best player on the floor. Like, that's not any surprise, right? Like, that's going to be the case in almost every game that they play.
First and second?
Yeah, but I also think they have the third.
Yep.
Fourth
yep.
best. That's
keep
where
going.
This one starts. Yeah, exactly. Like, I just don't know. Yeah. Like, I know you take KK over any of these players. You take Sarah Williams over any of these players. You take Blanc over any of these Blanc players. Like, I just, yeah. It's just, I just Ash? Don't. Ash, like.
Even Kaylee's probably where the conversation starts, but, like.
Yeah.
I'm looking at their schedule. Some notable results. They lost to UCLA by 18. That's,
I mean, obviously.
Yeah, but, like, the most obvious comparison between the second-best team in the country to the first team, and that was also the third game of the year. So, like, I don't want to throw a whole lot of stock into that.
No.
They've lost to Louisville twice. One of them was an OT game that they somehow lost by 10. That's kind of impressive.
Yeah.
They got blown out by Notre Dame 73-50. They needed overtime to beat Syracuse. They beat Florida State by 27. I think that's roughly the same as what UConn beat them by. They lost to Louisville again by 8 in the ACC tournament. And then they beat Maryland by 8 in the second round. So it doesn't help. Like, if it was Maryland, we'd be talking about Mirror, we'd be talking about Sailor. There'd be plenty of storylines to dive into. This just feels like such a vanilla matchup. I hate to say it in an NCAA tournament game, but such is life with this team.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't do anything for me.
How about 27.5, if that is the actual line, but even if it's not, we'll stick with it. I feel like I'm pretty comfortable taking that one.
Yeah. It's just the way this team played against Syracuse. I feel pretty good that they probably will win this by like 30. Yeah. It doesn't feel egregious. Apparently the halftime spread of the Syracuse game went to 78.5.
Oh my God.
That is egregious. This is not egregious.
I
did come log back into work when I got home last night to a ping from one of our partners saying the halftime spread was 78.5. That's not good for women's basketball.
That's crazy. I am, like, there was a part of me that was a little disappointed that it finished as a 53-point win.
Yeah.
Not that I wanted them to, like, I do genuinely like Felicia, so I didn't want them to, like, make it 100 or whatever, but whenever you have a chance to cover some history, I always like to try and get it.
Right, so. Like, there was certainly an opportunity to break some records in that game that did not happen.
Yeah, and, I mean, we probably should have talked about it earlier, but Gino said they pulled off the press, and basically once they pulled off the press, it kind of threw everything else off for them because they're so used to that just being part of the way they play.
Yeah.
I have not a single thing to be concerned about in that second half. I'm not.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't even need to talk about it.
The depth of the bench played a large portion of it. Like, there's nothing, to be worried about.
Yeah. So look ahead to the Elite Eight, since we both think they're going to win in the Sweet 16. It's either going to be Vanderbilt or Notre Dame. Notre Dame knocks off Ohio State. A bit of a surprise. I will say, Neil Ivey, I think, has been to the Sweet 16 every single year she's been the coach at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And that's involved teams that weren't expected to get to the Sweet 16, and it also included teams that were supposed to get a lot farther than the Sweet 16, and they all end in the Sweet 16. For simply that reason alone, I'm picking Vanderbilt, but what do you like about this matchup?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's kind of similar to the way that you would have talked about the Notre Dame-Ohio State matchup, in that, like, you've got kind of two stars going head-to-head, right? Like, I mean, maybe not exactly a direct matchup the way that Hannah Hidalgo and Jelena Cambridge were, but you've got Hannah Hidalgo and then you've got Michaela Blakes on the other side. So that's what's going to steal all the headlines. But I think a lot of times when you look at these games, like, that's what everyone talks about. But Hannah Hidalgo is going to score her 25 points and Michaela Blakes is going to score her 25 points. And ultimately who wins, it actually comes down to like what you get from everyone else. And I just think I like what Vanderbilt has around Blake's a little bit more in this one.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Notre Dame is a six seed for a reason, right? And I think my biggest takeaway watching them in stores earlier this season is Hannah Hidalgo is still Hannah Hidalgo. I just didn't think the rest of that surrounding cast was impressive. And I haven't seen Vandy a ton, but I think the body of works just kind of speak for themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think the pieces around Hannah at Notre Dame have improved as the season's gone on. Like, I think it looks a lot better than it did when UConn saw them. I think they've, in February and into March now, they've really figured things out quite a bit more than they had in December and January. It just did not look good there at all, right? But at the same time, they still, like, they don't have any size. And, like, Vanderbilt's got some, like, players like Sasha Washington that are just going to be able to, I think, really succeed in the post because they're used to playing against players that are bigger than them in the SEC, and now are going to have this opportunity where, like, they are the big bigs and, like, are going to be able to find a lot of success. So I just think that advantage tips its hat to Vanderbilt.
We'll have more time to talk about this in depth either on a rapid recap that may not be that rapid, or we might even have some time to record going into the Elite Eight, but I think the path to a potential upset for UConn is, like, basically the exact same for both teams. It's their star player going nuclear and UConn not being able to stop it, and then combined with, like, a bad shooting night from UConn. If Blake's goes out and scores 50, if Hidalgo goes out and scores 50 with 20 steals, or I don't know if that's a real number, 10 steals, and just takes over, and UConn plays poorly, like, yeah, that can happen. UConn does have a lot. They can probably afford to make it so that anybody but that player is going to beat them, but that doesn't always work. Basketball is the type of sport where one player can carry you a really long ways, and it just feels like such a, the way that they're similar teams, it feels like their path to victory is very similar too.
Yeah, I agree. This is one where, like, do I think they're going to beat UConn? No, but, like, you can see the path, right? When you have players like that on the floor, Mikayla Blake can be the best player on the floor in the game. Hannah Hidalgo can be the best player on the floor in the game, and then that always makes you vulnerable if the other team is capable of having the best player. That doesn't mean that they're going to be, like, Sarah Strong or Azy Flood, or could very much be the best player on the floor in the game, and they can very well be the first and second best player on the floor in the game against those two, but those teams have that capacity to have the best player on the floor, and I think that's what makes it possible for them to upset UConn, is, like, if Mikayla Blake goes out, because I think it's likely going to be Blake's, like, if it's Mikayla Blake that, like, goes out and scores 50 points, and, like, she's done it before, it's not unheard of. That creates some trouble for UConn, for sure. It doesn't mean they can't win if she scores 50 points, but it certainly makes it a lot more difficult.
Yeah. I just know this is, if it's Vanderbilt more so, I just know this is going to be the type of game where I say right now, like, they're going to be fine. They're going to get through. We're going to be in Phoenix. I'm not really worried about it. We're going to go through all the press conferences and locker rooms on Saturday, and then we're going to be talking either on a pod or just to each other, and I'm going to start getting nervous, and I'm going to start thinking. I'm going to start thinking about the ways that this could go wrong and all of that.
Yeah, I feel like I remember specifically, like, last year, like, before the UCLA game. Like, I'm sure we talked about it. And we were like, they're going to win this game. But then, like, I don't know, you just, like, as you're sitting there and you think about it, it's because you're thinking about it too much. And then you just start to, like, figure out, oh, they lose it. And yeah.
I distinctly remember getting really worried about UCLA last year. And Gino's kind of talked about it, where you only think about everything the other team has and how they can beat you and all of that, and you never think about, well, they also have to stop UConn,
right?
We're so used to talking about UConn, looking at UConn, every team looks good at this point in the year, and maybe not North Carolina. I'm sure if I dug into North Carolina enough, maybe I'd be able to convince myself, but yeah, I think I'm probably going to be nervous, and then they're going to be up 30 at halftime, and they're not actually. I don't actually think they're going to be up 30 at halftime, but
it'll be comfortable. It'll be a lot of stress for nothing.
I remember someone made a comment to me before the UCLA game, like, if UConn loses tomorrow, what are you going to do for your 2 days you have until you fly home? And I literally didn't know how to answer. I was like, I don't know. That possibility never crossed my mind.
Right.
And I remembered, like, we're already in Tampa for a few days, and there's only so much you can do in Tampa when you don't have a car, when you're limited by foot. And I'm, like, looking up stuff, and I'm like, I'm going to be so bored for 2 days if they don't win this. Like, how am I going to pull this off? And, again, they were up 30 at halftime.
Yeah. Didn't need to be worried about it.
No.
Did not have any free time.
No. I'm confident it's going to happen this year in the Elite Eight. It's going to happen in the national semifinal, mm-hmm. especially if it's against South Carolina and if they get to the national championship. Actually, last year, national championship, I was like, yeah, they're not losing.
There was no way Pitt is losing this game. Yeah.
Just like they did that to UCLA, how South Carolina is supposed to beat them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, a bunch of you joined our Chasing Perfection and UConn Women's Basketball Weekly bracket group. 56 of you in particular, 55 of you filled out a bracket. I stand tall at 52nd. And look, I'm looking at my bracket now, and I know exactly every single pick I've gotten wrong for the most part was simply because I wanted that one instead, not any logical reason. Iowa State? Nope. Maryland beating UNC? Nope. Fairfield beating Notre Dame? I didn't actually think they were going to beat Notre Dame. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
Then I had Ohio State going to the Elite Eight. That one didn't work out. Picking South Dakota State to the Sweet 16, that wasn't a smart choice. Like, Rhode Island beating Alabama. I knew I was in.
Yes.
I was in trouble. I'd rather do that than just pick the higher seed.
Exactly. I like to have fun with it. Also, my, like, love for the mid-major teams, I have to put it in the bracket. I don't know what it is. I can't not put it in the bracket. It's like I don't have faith in them if I don't put it there.
Yeah. I just find it, like, I'm looking, every time you log on to the tournament challenge, you see prominently the, like, celebrity brackets who have the highest, and Jay Harris is 99.7, Nicole Briscoe's 96.6. Without even clicking, like, what are the odds that they've just picked the higher seed in every single game?
Yeah. And that will get you there in the women's one, so.
Yeah. It is what it is. I'm okay. I can live with where I was. I predicted this was going to happen. This exact thing was going to happen.
I'm not doing much better, to be fair. I think I'm 30-something. Yes, so it's not much of an improvement.
My men's bracket's at least, like, 50%. So
I don't even know what's in my men's bracket other than the men, like, UConn winning. Other than that, I've watched zero non-UConn men's basketball games this year. I just picked it at them.
Same. I don't have faith. Do I don't have any faith in the men winning the national championship, but I still picked them.
Put it there because what else is that going to do? I have no idea who else would win the national championship.
Well, also, like, we've seen it so many times, especially since 2011. Oh, 2011, I was fully confident that team was winning the national championship. I won a bracket that year at my mom's work, I think. But, like, I just don't want to. I would rather pick them and be wrong than not pick them
and have them win.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'd love if I didn't pick them and they won. But, like, I would just feel like such an idiot if I didn't pick them and they won.
Yes, exactly.
So, I almost forgot to mention the top of our leaderboard. So we will go. Oh, there are a lot of people tied in second. Oh, boy. Okay, so Kay Ginter, 20, is 99.7 right now. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people tied in second. We got Lison 3, Elizabeth. Should I not be reading these names out?
Oh, that's a good point. Maybe not.
Okay, you're going to hear some choppy audio because I'm going to cut out some of the names here. Mm-hmm. That one maybe more so than the others because it's a full name. Because then we've got ESPN with a bunch of numbers after it. We have ESPN fan. This is also a public group, so you can go and look it up.
Yeah.
Taylor's picks, Joe's picks, ESPN with a bunch of numbers after it. So you guys are all tied for second. A lot of tournament still to go. I do appreciate cat named Katie Lou as a name. I am.
There was also a power of friendship in there I saw. I like that one too.
There is. There's one person in this group that didn't pick UConn to win the national championship. Not stunning given both the team and the population we're pulling from. But they picked UCLA and the name is Can Corey Close? That's a funny pun and the answer is no. And then, yeah. All the people that we would recognize all at the bottom.
Yes.
So, I'd rather be here than at the top, not picking with my heart. That's yes. Okay.
It's no fun to not pick with your heart.
No. That belief that I have in South Dakota State to go to the Sweet 16, that'll live in me forever. So.
You almost had it right. Like, you were in the right quadrant of the bracket for it to be a weird one. Just picked the wrong double-digit seed.
Yeah. I didn't even pick Illinois in the first game, which, like, no, not Illinois.
Virginia.
Same, both orange teams. Yeah. But no regrets. Like, you're not going to get everyone, right?
Yeah. So,
but we'll check back in after the regionals to see who's leading, who's doing good. That'll do it for this episode of Chasing Perfection. Next time we talk to you, we will be in Fort Worth wrapping up. Quick rapid recap of the Sweet 16 matchup against North Carolina. Presuming they get through, we will hopefully try and preview Vanderbilt going into that one. And then if they get through that one and head to Phoenix, we will have a full-on Final Four preview. So thanks for listening, and yeah, we'll be talking to you from a much warmer location. Can't wait. Hallelujah.
It was snowing in stores when we left last night. We didn't mention that.
snowing, sleeting. It was all terrible. All of it. I can't wait. I'm a winter person, but I'm ready for it to be done.
I'm already not a winter person, so we're just afraid over here.
Yeah, it's time. I can't wait to get nice and crispy. All right, that'll do it. Thanks for listening.